This is a Triple J podcast.
Prescription pills, it was alcohol, it was ice, it was G.
That may be the view of young people, it's not the view of our government.
If I don't meet a girl, it's pretty hard to tell her that I'm uncontactable.
To connect, to have a good time, to dance it off like nobody's watching.
This is going to have an effect for generations to come.
We're just over a week into summer, and for a lot of Australians, it is definitely feeling like summer. Bushfires in multiple states, already deadly, homes lost, warnings we could be in for a horrible season. So what does it feel like to be signing up to fight these fires? Are you sacrificing your summer to help protect your community? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, you're going to meet the young people who are doing just this.
There's nowhere near as many volunteers as we need. It is a big organisation, but so is Australia.
Yeah, that's coming up. Also ahead, the worst kept secret in politics, Barnaby Joyce defecting to One Nation. Also, can vaping too much give you a heart attack? There's some stories out on that at the moment, so we're going to dive into that chat very soon. First, though, big news out of WA and a warning. This story discusses incidents of self-harm and contains the name of an Indigenous person who has died.
You're listening to Hack.
It is an immense tragedy when a child makes a decision to end their life. It raises the question, how was this allowed to happen?
On Triple J.
The name Cleveland Dodd is etched into Australia's memory. The first recorded death in Western Australian youth detention. Cleveland was 16 when he fatally self-harmed in the notorious Unit 18 youth detention facility in 2023. More than 2 years later, a coroner has handed down his findings after an inquest. So what has he found? Well, let's ask ABC reporter Kaysen Ho, who is across this. Kaysen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Dave.
Can you remind us of the circumstances leading up to Cleveland's death?
Definitely. So one thing to really understand the importance of these findings is to understand what Unit 18 actually is. So WA only had one dedicated youth detention facility, which was called Banksia Hill, but it was quite a troubled facility with riots and authorities saying that many of the detainees were destroying their cells and infrastructure, and they created Unit 18 as a sort of stopgap measure. It was supposed to only exist for 12 months, and it was created inside a maximum security adult prison. This unit where authorities would send who they described as some of the more difficult to manage detainees to house them. And it's now functioned for about 3 years it's been around. And that's where Cleveland Dodd was actually sent and where he fatally self-harmed.
In terms of the warning and any kind of indication that this was going to happen, did the inquest hear that authorities were negligent?
Definitely. So essentially, despite the authorities' efforts to create Unit 18 as a place where they could manage some of these more difficult to manage detainees, many who had serious neurocognitive disorders, there were serious warnings raised by many people, children's court judges, from advocates, from legal experts who looked at Unit 18 and the conditions inside there and said they were inhumane and actually predicted that it was inevitable for a death in custody to occur inside of Unit 18. Now, some of those conditions included detainees that were kept in their cells for up to 23 hours a day, and that was the case for most of Cleveland Dodd's time inside of Unit 18. In the days leading up to Cleveland's death, he actually didn't have any running water inside of his cell, and, you know, CCTV cameras that were intended to monitor many of these at-risk detainees inside of their cells, most of them were effectively non-functional because they had been covered up by the detainees or broken and hadn't been fixed. And a major point that the coroner raised as well was that many of these cells actually had ligature points. One of them Cleveland actually used to self-harm in his cell where he hanged himself. And just before he did that, the coroner noted that there was actually another detainee earlier that night that did the exact same thing in their own cell with a similar ligature point. So many of these issues have been raised numerous times before authorities were given those warnings, and they were aware of those warnings, the coroner said, but they chose not to act, at least not enough.
What else did Coroner Philip Urquhart have to say, Kaysen?
So he hammered home the importance of closing Unit 18 essentially as a matter of urgency, and he wanted an inquiry to be held into the founding of Unit 18 or the creation of Unit 18 to figure out exactly the exact circumstances in which it came to be. Some of the details that came out in this coronial inquest looked at sort of the proactive measures essentially that were taken when creating Unit 18 to make sure that it could actually adequately care for some of these detainees who, again, many of whom had serious neurocognitive disorders, you know, had serious mental health needs as well. And the coroner was at pains to sort of describe the fact that many of these services were actually lacking, that the frontline staff, they were understaffed, they were contending with not actually having the resources to deal with everything that they needed to. And a lot of the issues were, in fact, systemic issues, not the fault of just frontline staff, but systemic issues that had been boiling for a long time.
Let's have a listen to some of what Coroner Philip Urquhart had to say.
I am satisfied that for a state which is part of a first world nation to solitarily confine a 16-year-old child in a cell for the length of time that Cleveland was held was not only entirely inappropriate, but inhumane.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with ABC reporter Kaysen Ho regarding the findings of an inquest into the death of Cleveland Dodd, who died in WA youth detention a couple of years ago. Kaysen, what's the reaction been like to these findings today?
So the recommendations and the findings from Coroner Urquhart are long, and it'll take a bit of time to actually go through them all. But in terms of the recommendations themselves, many of them have already been dismissed by the Department of Justice, especially calls to close down Unit 18 as a matter of urgency, among a few others. And that's been met with disappointment and dismay from the family, but also supporters who've been following this journey for the past 2 years since Cleveland Dodd died. Many of these people have warned that something like closing Unit 18 was a necessary measure, and that's what they've been hoping for. It's something that the coroner has sort of foreshadowed throughout the coronial inquest as a recommendation that he'd make. But the government says, you know, that's not possible at this stage. They need to build a new facility, a new youth detention facility first before Unit 18 can be closed. But of course, people on the other side, many of whom have been warning about the dangers of Unit 18 for a long time, say that's just not the case and that it needs to be treated more urgently. Again, Unit 18 was only supposed to be open for 12 months and has now been operating for about 3 years.
Thank you very much for keeping us up to date with all of that, ABC reporter Kaysen Ho. Appreciate your time.
Thanks, Dave.
And in a statement, Cleveland's mum, Nadine Dodd, has said, "I believe that Cleveland's death was the product of institutional abuse and neglect, and it breaks my heart to know that Cleveland spent 23 hours a day or more for days on end locked down in a filthy cell with no end in sight." She goes on to say, "Well, I hope that his death and Coroner Urquhart's findings and recommendations will lead to the change required to prevent other children from suffering the way my son did. It depends upon a massive fundamental shift in the Department of Justice's approach to youth justice, which has yet to be seen." And just a reminder, if this has raised any issues for you, if you do need support, Lifeline is on 13 11 14.
Hack. The major population of the RFS is an ageing population.
On Triple J.
Yes, summer's here, and while a lot of people might be celebrating, looking forward to long beach days, time off work, days with mates, relaxing, for many Australians, it can be a really anxious time, particularly if you're in an area that's often at threat of bushfires. Because we've seen, bushfire season has well and truly kicked off in many parts of the country. Over the weekend, we saw dozens of homes destroyed in different states. A person has already been killed while fighting a blaze in Western Australia. So what does it feel like to be signing up to help protect communities? Have you ever thought about it? Maybe you're in your local fire service. Message in 0439 757 555. Alice Angeloni headed down to her local fire control centre to meet some of the volunteers.
I'm heartbroken that we've lost a life as a result of the bushfires.
There's a family man, a great community man, just a passionate guy who was passionate about farming. He's going to be greatly missed.
It's officially been summer for a week and already there have been homes lost.
We need to get the heck out of here! Cook!
Evacuations ordered and terrible tragedies.
Look, it's a sad day for New South Wales.
Including a farmer who lost his life in WA last week and another man, a National Parks worker who was confirmed dead in New South Wales this morning. Around Australia, fireys are warning things will get worse.
I think this fire season could potentially be very catastrophic for some areas of Australia.
Joel Brady is in his 20s and has been out firefighting in WA, near Geraldton.
So we spent about 15 hours out on the fire ground that day. We did get quite close to housing, right up against fences, people's front yards, had grass fires, and definitely very confronting.
That fire destroyed a home and left others uninhabitable. Joel says it's left he and his colleagues worried too.
I'm hoping that's probably the worst we're going to have for a long time.
In New South Wales and Tasmania in the last few days, 40 homes have also been lost to bushfires. It's a sign of the strain to come on paid firefighters and volunteers too. With the New South Wales Premier Chris Minns and the Federal Emergency Management Minister Christy McBain both saying volunteers are essential to keeping the country safe this fire season.
We don't have a plan B. Our firefighting efforts in New South Wales depend on men and women signing up and in some cases putting themselves in harm's way to save and protect complete strangers. I realise it's not for everybody, but it is for some people.
The time where people literally run away from what is quite a harrowing experience, we've got members of our community that run towards it to protect not only property, but livestock and livelihoods. So, you know, they deserve our utmost thanks. What they really want is more people to join them.
So how is Australia going at signing up new volleys? Well, there's a shortage.
I'd just see my dad roll out to a fire. He'd get a ding on his phone and he'd go, oop, gotta run.
Cora is 18 and lives in Coffs Harbour on the New South Wales mid-north coast. Growing up, she watched her dad head out to fires and now she does it too.
When you're rolling up, sometimes you go, oh my God, that fire's a little bit bigger than I anticipated. If you've got a good captain like mine and a good crew, then you have a quick brief, you calm down pretty quickly.
But like the government, Cora's concerned both about the number of volunteers.
There's nowhere near as many volunteers as we need. It is a big organisation, but so is Australia.
And the median age. She says her colleagues are getting older.
There has definitely been concern spoken about we're not getting new members, we need them.
Something other young volleys are noticing too.
We've currently got 28 total members in our fire brigade. We've only got 4 people under the age of 30.
I'm the youngest and practically everyone else is mainly in their 60s.
So what's holding people back?
Mainly because they think that the process of joining is long.
What the news shows is that split second of a crowning fire where there's a little firefighter pointing a little hose, but that's maybe 1 out of 100 fires.
Potentially something to do with people's time commitments.
Maddie is 25 and also a volunteer firefighter in New South Wales. She's just started working as an occupational therapist, balancing that with volunteer work.
The motto is work and family come first. The RFS then tends like to come in underneath.
But let's be clear, these young volunteers also face some really confronting situations.
You do see some quite horrific scenes.
But Maddie says there's good support.
You can also choose whether or not you want to go to those call-outs. At the back of the truck, this is our pump. This is where
Maddie is showing me one of the fire trucks that she's been learning how to drive. And that's definitely one thing all of these young volunteers are telling me. You gain a lot of great skills. So should you sign up? For Cora, it's a good way to contribute.
You touch base with people in a much different way than you usually would, and it just shows you how wonderful the world can be in a different way, and just faith in humanity really steps up.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there, and yeah, good to hear from some of the volunteers who have already signed up. And maybe there are some other people who are listening to this now who are thinking, yes, maybe I can do this. I'm in a position to help out. We are hearing from some of those on the text line now. Others, though, are saying it's hard. Someone, I would love to volunteer. Unfortunately, I also have to work and I can't take time off. Another person, it is really hard to commit to any form of volunteering with the economic strain currently being placed on young adults. Look, let's find out a bit more about what is ahead for us in the months to come. And Hamish Clark is a Senior Research Fellow of Future Fire Risk at the University of Melbourne. Hamish, thank you very much for joining us on Hack.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Dave.
We've got the Prime Minister out there today saying we're in for a very difficult summer. Is that your understanding as well? Like, looking ahead into the next few months, what do you think it's going to be like?
Yeah, look, it's hard to predict, but absolutely. We've already seen terrible impacts now. My condolences to the family and loved ones of this poor firefighter who's passed away in New South Wales. There's big fires happening there, Tasmania and other places. So, yeah, it's not going to be unexpected if there's more fire activity.
Is it pretty unusual to be seeing so many fires, so devastating as well, this early on into summer?
Not necessarily. You know, we have different fire seasons in different parts of the country. So, yeah, in a lot of these parts that we're seeing fires now, it's relatively normal to have fire then. But, of course, the impacts vary from year to year. We can have a quiet one and we can have, obviously, off-the-charts ones too.
What makes the risk so great at the moment? Is it just high temperatures? Is it because we've had a lot of rain over the past few months and there might be a lot of fuel? Like, what is adding to the risk?
Yeah, look, it's a good question. And I mean, fire is a complicated thing. It's been around on the planet for hundreds of millions of years. So one way to think about it is you need several key ingredients, right? You need something to burn, you need fuel. That fuel's got to be dry enough to burn. So, you know, thankfully, that's why we don't get fires in rainforests very often. But those two aren't enough. You also need an ignition. And then you need, you know, weather conditions, you know, this kind of hot, dry, windy conditions, which can make a fire really hard to control. So it's when you get all those things together that, you know, we have the chance of having really devastating fires.
Are we getting better at predicting when fires are likely to start or where they're likely to be?
Yes, we're getting better all the time, but they're still very hard to predict and we're not quite able to pinpoint, yes, we think there'll be an ignition here, that we just don't have that technology. What we can do is assess different landscapes, these different risk factors, and we can try and monitor what's happening, you know, through communities, through technology, through satellites, so that we can find out about them once an ignition does occur.
Are our firefighting techniques changing to meet this increased risk of fire across the country? Like, are there new ways of fighting fires that we're learning about or we're implementing?
Yeah, absolutely. Fire agencies do an amazing job in really difficult circumstances, and they're pretty well plugged into the research. They've got a lot of operational knowledge. We speak of new ways. There's also old ways too, right? Australia's had Indigenous people expertly caring for country and using fire for tens of thousands of years. So what I'm about, and I think a lot of people are on the same page, is trying to bring together all the different kinds of expertise and knowledge we have so that we can find some ways to sustainably coexist with fire.
What do you think people should know heading into summer? Like, if you're in an area which may be at higher risk than another area, what should you be keeping in the back of your mind?
Yeah, look, just being aware is a great start. So knowing about the risk in your area, talking to friends and family, local fire authorities are a great source of information for things you can do, things like developing a plan, what would be your trigger to leave, what would you do, how would you get out, do you have more than one way to get out? There's things you can do to prepare your home. It's good to check in on vulnerable, you know, neighbours. So there's a lot that we can do.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Hamish Clark from the University of Melbourne. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
And a lot of comments coming through on this one. Someone saying, yeah, I want to sign up. I'm looking into it. Another person says, I'm a Country Fire Association member. Support in the local brigades is excellent. Lots of farmers and like-minded people. Definitely potential for a bad season upcoming in southwest Victoria, that person says. Francis from Ngunnawal Country says volunteers from firefighters to lifesavers and blood donors should get additional tax deductions. Yeah, there's a few people saying we should be incentivising this. We need to come up with a system of paying firefighters, especially as the risk of bushfires increases. Someone else says half the fireys in Victoria are walking off the job because they're not getting the support they need, running out of food, overworked and late shifts. And someone else says, I've been a volunteer firefighter for 11 years now. I love it. But there is so much pressure between work and family. It's a massive balancing act. Well, make sure you keep across whatever is happening near you by staying tuned into ABC local radio. Also, ABC News generally will keep you updated.
You're listening to Hack.
Former Deputy Prime Minister Barnaby Joyce has joined One Nation
on Triple J.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say this is the worst kept secret in Canberra. People speculating for weeks that Pauline Hanson was actively trying to recruit former leader of the Nationals, Barnaby Joyce, to join her on One Nation. Well, last week, Barnaby Joyce officially quit the Nationals party, said he'd have more to say later in the year, and today he officially announced he is joining One Nation. Our political reporter Shalala Medora explains.
Point made an offer to me to come to One Nation and I have taken that up.
After weeks of speculation, Barnaby Joyce has finally made the leap to One Nation. He made the announcement this morning alongside Pauline Hanson on a commercial FM radio station in Tamworth in his electorate.
I'm very aware that there'll be some hurt in this decision and I understand that.
Barnaby Joyce was, until a fortnight ago when he sensationally quit, one of the most recognisable faces in the National Party. But he now says his views are more aligned with Pauline Hanson than with his old colleagues in the Nats.
On the premise of where I believe I'm philosophically aligned with One Nation and with that, you know, I'm a Conservative, I'm not embarrassed about it.
Barnaby Joyce says he'll stay in his House of Rep seat of New England until the next election, which isn't until 2028, at which point he'll give it up and switch to run for a Senate seat for One Nation. All of this is happening while One Nation enjoys record popularity. In some surveys, polling as high as 18%. Pauline Hanson says she and Barnaby will make a formidable team.
And I think that with Barnaby on board with One Nation now, that we will push forward. We will hold both the Labor and the opposition to account.
So why now? Barnaby Joyce has twice been the leader of the Nationals Party, including two stints as Deputy Prime Minister. In 2018, he was forced to resign from ministerial and leadership positions after being publicly rebuked by Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull for having an affair with his staffer.
Barnaby made a shocking error of judgment.
Something which set in motion a so-called bonk ban in Parliament House, barring ministers from having sex with members of their staff.
I am making today some changes to the ministerial standards.
But then he came back, regaining the leadership and the Deputy Prime Minister job in June 2021, before losing the leadership to David Littleproud when the Coalition lost the 2022 election. He's been on the backbench ever since, and it's fair to say it's not his vibe.
I don't like being stuck down the back in a corner, to be quite frank. I'm a front row forward, and front row forwards want to be in the middle of the ruck.
He's clashed with the current leaders of the Coalition over things like climate change, which has frayed the relationship.
Our party has given him the great honour and privilege to lead not only the Nationals, but to also serve as the Deputy Prime Minister of the country. To then walk away from the party that gave you that honour, I think is incredibly disappointing.
Former Nats leader Michael McCormack said he's bound to butt heads with Pauline Hanson too.
You've got two very alpha, strong, dominant people who like to lead, who like to be the front person, who like to be the one who's running the show. They're going to clash.
Meanwhile, Labor is loving the drama, with Treasurer Jim Chalmers trying to make the most of the Coalition's divisions.
Well, the Coalition is now so bad that not even Barnaby Joyce wants to hang around them.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Shalala Medora reporting there, and someone on the text line says it was the steak on the sandwich press that did the trick. Yeah, maybe that was what really got Barnaby over the line. Look, we're going to have more politics later this week. As I mentioned earlier, we've got a few shake-ups to round out this week, our last week on air. And on Thursday, it's our political shake-up, unpacking the year of politics. And we've got a great panel. We've got Hannah Ferguson from Cheek Media, former WA Liberal leader Zach Kirkup as well. So that's coming up on Thursday. It'll be a good one.
Hack.
Vaping is actually personal enemy number one for me. I hate to sound like a boomer, but I am really fearful about the health implications.
On Triple J.
Yeah, if you love vaping, you probably know it's not good for you. Popcorn lung, withdrawals. We've talked about the impacts of vaping before. But what about heart attack? Is that something you've ever thought about? Because over the weekend, a reality TV star, Fraser Olander from Below Deck, revealed that he almost died because of his vaping addiction. He says he suffered vape poisoning, which led to a heart attack. And he is urging young people around the world to quit cold turkey right now, saying it's not worth the risk. Well, let's find out more about the risks with Dr. Alex Larkham, an associate professor at Curtin University's School of Population Health. Alex, thanks very much for joining us on Hack.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
Vaping causing a heart attack in a young person, is this a risk that we've known about for a while?
It's scary seeing this in the news just in the last couple of days. And it's something we've known about for a little while, that vaping can cause this. This is by no means the first time a young person has had a heart attack attributed to vaping, but it's not very common, and it's not something that people generally think is one of the risks of vaping.
So what causes the heart attack? Like, do we know more about how this all works?
Yeah, I mean, because it's fairly rare, there's not a huge amount of information on how it actually causes it. But we know that the chemicals in vapes, primarily the nicotine and some other bits and pieces, can and do impact sort of the electrical functioning of the heart, so they can change it, how it beats, make it go faster or slower. They can interrupt some of the electrical signals that a normal heartbeat has, and that sounds like what happened to Fraser. Some of those sort of the normal heart functioning electrical signals that happened got interrupted, which caused this constriction of the blood vessels and a reduction of blood flow. So, yeah, we know that that can happen. We know that it can change blood pressure as well, and we know that these things can happen in people with otherwise healthy hearts. They do occur, obviously, in this instance, in someone who'd had no previous history of heart-related issues.
Yeah, I think that's one of the scarier things, is that it was a young person who, by all accounts, is really healthy and wasn't expecting this to happen. He's obviously been freaked out by this and saying, I'm giving up vaping, and urging other people to give up vaping too. Do you think there are other health impacts that we just don't know about yet, Alex, because, you know, vaping hasn't been around for a huge amount of time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are health effects that we know are caused by vaping. But as you say, because they've only really been around and in common use, for want of a better word, for maybe a decade or so, we don't know what the long-term effects are. What's going to happen to someone who's been vaping for 20 or 30 years? That sort of information just isn't available. But the evidence suggests that if you're breathing in some of these chemicals for a long enough period of time, there are going to be health effects that haven't manifest yet. So, for example, there's not links in humans, strong links between vaping and lung cancers or other cancers. But if someone does it for a long enough period of time, then maybe those things will manifest down the track.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Alex Larcombe, an associate professor at Curtin School of Population Health. We're talking about vaping on the back of this news that a reality TV star, Fraser Olander, had a heart attack recently and is saying, you know, his vaping was to blame. He's urging young people around the world to give up vaping, saying he didn't know that was a risk, and obviously it's changed his life. Alex, do we know what is in these vapes? I know this is like something that gets brought up a lot, but are there generally chemicals that are used consistently in vapes that we know are dangerous, or there's just, it's a lucky dip, we've got no idea?
It's somewhere in between those two things. So there are standard sort of chemicals and ingredients that are in the majority of vapes. So the bulk of them is the two liquids, glycerin and propylene glycol, which are fairly benign on their own. Like you could theoretically drink those in their raw form and have no problems, but the heating of them inside the vape causes them to change and break down and produce a range of other nasties. Most vapes that people use, although not all of them, but most of them contain nicotine, which we know has various impacts on people's functioning. And then there's this suite of other things as well. So a whole range of different flavouring chemicals can be in there. There's other solvents that can be in there. And all of these things are sort of vary between what brand you use and what flavours you use and all sorts of things. So it is a lucky dip. There's lots of people sort of researching this as we speak and finding new chemicals and nasties in there all the time.
And just finally, what are the symptoms of vape poisoning? Like if you're going through something quite serious, what should you be looking out for?
Yeah, so most vape poisoning that is sort of being reported is where people have drank the e-liquid accidentally or deliberately, but you can get it from vaping, inhaling the vape just in the sort of normal fashion. And the vape poisoning, if you use it enough, it's some fairly unpleasant sort of symptoms, so nausea, sweating, vomiting, headaches. It can produce drooling and altered heartbeat, as we mentioned before, changes in blood pressure. So feeling pretty sick, it's often called nic sick, is the low level sort of poisoning from these sorts of things. And if it gets worse than that, it can obviously become much more severe, as we saw with Fraser, and that can cause people to die effectively, very serious outcomes.
Yeah, it's horrible to hear about and to think about. Thank you for giving us a bit of an explanation of what happens to your body and what the potential risks are. Alex Larcombe, Associate Professor at Curtin School of Population Health. Really appreciate you coming on Hack.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And that is all we've got time for on Hack for now.
Hack.